The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week's show is all about fraud of a mostly medical nature. Dr. Stephen Barrett joins us to discuss Quackwatch, a network of websites that discusses the fact and fiction around alternative health treatments. James, the amazing Randy, shares a lesson about the history of scams, and Jamie Williams of the Center for Inquiry Vancouver explains his new project, fighting the illegal sale of ear candles in Canada. Before we get to our interviews, I want to take a moment to welcome four new frequencies to the family of fine stations that broadcast Skeptically Speaking. They are the KJAZZ Radio Network in Arizona and Nevada in the U.S. That's KJZA 89.5 FM in Williams, Grand Canyon and Flagstaff, KJZP 90.1 FM in Prescott, Prescott Valley and the Tri-Cities area, KJZK 90.7 FM in Kingman, Lachlan, and the Las Vegas area, and KJZA 91.3 FM in Flagstaff, Munns Park, and Sedona. Welcome, KJAZZ. We're happy to have you on the team. And now, here's our hour on quacks, charlatans, and scams. Enjoy. We're on location at the amazing meeting in Las Vegas, and I'm here with James Randy, magician, investigator, and namesake of the James Randy Educational Foundation, a not-for-profit organization founded in 1996. The foundation promotes critical thinking by reaching out to the public and the media with reliable information about paranormal and supernatural ideas. Hello, Randy.
Hi there. Good to be here.
So you've been a skeptic for how long?
Let me see. I'm 81 years of age. I think I started in 1929. I'd be 1 year old at that time. I've been a skeptic, I think, all my life. I've always asked questions. I've always said, how do you know that? And is there any evidence for that? And that's being a skeptic. Not a cynic, but a skeptic.
So let's talk about the evolution of the scam. When you first started out, what were the big scams?
When I was a kid, there were a lot of religious scams, as there are today, of course. But I was more or less aware of them because the local churches around where I lived in Toronto, Canada, or Leaside, actually, I should say technically, they were always being infiltrated and visited by everyone from Filipino psychic surgeons from the Far East and various kinds of faith healers and preachers that had miracle water that they were selling and magnets to put in your shoes and every conceivable thing. And my parents, in a couple of cases, actually fell for that and spent money on it. And that infuriated me because I kept asking my dad, but do you know that it works? Oh, I feel better after having the magnet in my shoe. And I would say to him, but that's not evidence. How do you know you wouldn't have felt better without the magnet? So I was a troublemaker from the very beginning, and my family had a hard time understanding me, I must say.
So what's changed since that time?
Well, it's just gotten more intense. As the technology has developed and the media have greater access to the public and the public to the media, of course, through the internet and by various other means, particularly television, of course, in recent decades, the kind of information and misinformation that can be broadcast out there becomes much more easy to disseminate. We can see ads, particularly after midnight, and if you've never done it, you really should try this experiment, folks. After midnight, tune in to some of the smaller channels and see what you hear there. You'll find evangelists, healers, people selling holy water from Israel and oil from the Mount of Olives and various other scams of that kind. They reach a vast audience, mostly of people who are up late at night or are not well or are in some sort of traumatic condition or they're grieving and they want some answers. And these people will apparently supply the answers to you. You'll get nothing but dismay out of it and you'll lose your money and you'll be very disappointed in the results. But then these people tend to go back to the chopping block to get another finger chopped off as soon as they lose on one of these investments and they find that it doesn't work. They seem to be fools for being victimized by all the scam artists. It's a billion-dollar business all over the world, and I find this to be all over the world. I just came back from another tour of Europe, and in every country I visited, they said exactly the same thing happens here. After midnight, these people are on TV, and they're sending around leaflets to the door and through the mail and on billboards everywhere. It's the same all around the world, from China to Australia to Canada, all the way down into South America, all over the world. The scams are out there.
And they're just preying on people's hopes, basically.
That's right, and their fears and their vulnerability, particularly the grieving people. People who have lost a loved one or have had some big financial reversal, for example, are very, very vulnerable to these things, and they're looking for answers, and they turn to magic.
So you think that with new technology and with the proliferation of media, it has gotten worse then?
I think it's gotten worse, unfortunately. You would think that since the good information is out there too, you would think that people might be paying more attention to that. But the lure of magic and easy answers is so strong that people will tend to go that way, particularly if they're not well educated and haven't got a good experience of how the world really works.
So then that being said, are there any successes that we can look at?
Oh, yes. The point that I've often made with folks who say you must be discouraged is that my email, every day without fail, something comes up on email or comes up in the regular mail. There is a thing called postal mail too. You actually put it inside a piece of paper. You see, it has a stamp on the outside. Yeah, you're too young to remember.
I've heard.
Yes, I'm sure. I'm well out of your age range there. But no, I get correspondence from people, and even by phone calls and visits to my office in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, from people who say, "Wow, you made a difference in my life," and that's the most important thing I can hear. That is, if the difference was positive. And in all cases that I can report on, yes, it has been positive. People have said, you got me thinking. Now, that's the bottom line. If I can get people thinking about these things, I don't say, believe what I say, don't believe what they say. I simply say, look at this situation from this particular point of view and consider this possibility. And the thank you notes I get from these people, boy, that makes my day. And you can often hear a little hallelujah coming from my office, and the staff says, he got another one.
So where do you think that we should be focusing? Which scams right now?
Well, particularly the medical scams. The quacks that are out there selling all kinds of nostrums and secret formulas and methods of success and whatnot. And I include that among quack medicine things too, because most of the success that they want people to have is financial success, so they can send some of that financial success to them. But they know they're not going to get that because these people are not going to make money. The people who are going to make money are the people who are selling these ideas to them. Quack medicine is extremely dangerous. People are buying increasingly medicines that are called homeopathic, that have no ingredients in them, no content whatsoever. They don't have any medicinal value. They do not work, and they have been tested endlessly, repeatedly, at all different cultures around the world. I've done it personally for my million-dollar challenge, as a matter of fact. And we've done it through the BBC in the UK, and the Royal Society sponsored the whole series of tests of homeopathy on live television. And they always fail. Now, something that always fails, always turns out to be a lie and a scam, you'd think would fall by the wayside. But the advertisers are so clever that they can turn failure into success. And they do. And they appeal to people. They say, oh, that's big pharma. That's the big pharmaceutical companies. Now, I just came through chemotherapy. I had colon cancer. I had the operation, went through the chemotherapy, 6 months of it. Not a lot of fun. But medical science is responsible for me being here and being able to speak to you on this microphone. Medical science, not homeopathy, not acupuncture, no prayers, no wishful thinking, no perfumes or incense. No, it was called medical science, and it bloody well works, and I wish people would be aware of that. Now, it's not perfect. I never said it was perfect, and no medical expert will ever tell you, no, this is absolutely certain to work. No, there are percentages involved. Some people can be saved. Some people can't. But that's the way nature is, and that's the way the world works. We can't win every battle that we go into. We try, and medical science certainly does it for most people.
Randy, I hope you live another 100 years.
I'm going to try. I'm working on it right now. I'm 81. Hey, 82 next month, as a matter of fact. Hey, I better get a birthday party together, I guess. Thank you so much for your courtesy.
Thank you for being here, Randy. And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking right after this. Hello, listeners. I bring you news about a new way that you can participate in the Skeptically Speaking experience. We're going to start recording interviews live on Sunday nights at 6 p.m. Mountain Time. You can listen to us record live and submit questions in our Ustream chat room just by clicking the Listen Live button on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. On Friday nights at 6 p.m., click that button again to listen to the complete show and chat with the team when Skeptically Speaking airs on our home station. And you'll still be able to submit questions for our guests on our website or by email, Twitter, Facebook, and our new voicemail system. Check the contact page at skepticallyspeaking.com for more information. We'll see you Sunday night at 6. Thanks for listening. I'm here with Jamie Williams, event coordinator for the Center for Inquiry in Vancouver. Welcome to the show, Jamie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you're here to talk about a project, but before we get to that, let's give the audience some background. What is an ear candle?
An ear candle, or ear cone, is a thin hollow tube of linen or muslin cloth soaked in paraffin or beeswax and tapered at one end. And generally they're 12 to 16 inches long. Sometimes you'll find them scented with herbs or aromatherapy oils.
So then what is ear candling?
Ear candling is an alternative treatment for a wide variety of symptoms. And it's the process of putting one of these ear candles, putting the tapered end in your ear, and lying on your side and lighting the open end of the candle. The idea of this, supposedly, is that the heat from the flame melts and loosens the wax in the ear canal and creates negative pressure, often referred to by proponents as the chimney effect, which draws the earwax and impurities out of the ear and into the candle. Most commonly, practitioners who offer this as a service say it removes toxins. They also say it relieves sinus pain and pressure, assists lymphatic circulation, fortifies the central nervous system, purifies the blood, improves hearing and other senses, stops tinnitus, ear infections, vertigo, migraines, all the way to opening and aligning chakras and spiritual centers, etc.
So what's the history? Is this new? How long has this been in use?
It only seems to have been popular for about 20 or so years. The most widely claimed origin is of the Hopi tribe of North America, and for this reason they're sometimes marketed as Hopi ear candles. But in truth, the Hopi people deny that they have ever used ear candling and are quite upset that people continue to use their name in marketing their products.
You mentioned a bunch of the benefits of ear candling. I get the impression that you don't agree.
I don't, and neither does the published research. There isn't much research in peer-reviewed journals on ear candling, but the few research papers that have been published mainly examined if the claimed method of action, the chimney effect, actually exists, and if the ear candling procedure actually removes any wax, and all results have been negative. The most frequently cited paper on this topic is Ear Candles, Efficacy and Safety, which was published in the journal Laryngoscope in 1996. And to quote from the abstract, tympanometric measurements in an ear canal model demonstrated that ear candles do not produce negative pressure. A limited clinical trials showed no removal of cerumen from the external auditory canal.
So does ear candling provide any benefit at all then?
No, it's not effective for any of the things which the proponents say that it can treat.
So I've heard that ear candling can actually be dangerous as opposed to just ineffective.
That's very true. Ear candling can be quite dangerous. In the laryngoscope study, which I just mentioned, they included a survey of 122 otolaryngologists who identified 21 ear injuries that they had experienced in their practice resulting from ear candle use, including painful burns in and around the ears from wax, which in some cases caused ear canal blockage, eardrum puncture, temporary loss of hearing or ringing in the ears. And there have also been articles published in newspapers reporting on house fires that were started by ear candles.
So for those reasons, really, the Canadian government has put some rules in place. Can you tell us what they are specifically?
Because of the research I just talked about and laboratory tests that Health Canada conducted themselves, they have classified ear candles as a Class 3 medical device. The Medical Devices Bureau of Health Canada has recognized four classes of devices based on the level of control necessary to assure the safety and effectiveness of the device. Class 1 devices present the lowest potential risk and don't require a license. Simple things like bandages and I think scalpels and such. Class 2 devices require a declaration of device safety and effectiveness from the manufacturer. And Class 3 and 4 devices are considered to present the greatest potential risk and are subjected to in-depth scrutiny and actually require licenses from Health Canada before they can be manufactured and sold. So the fact that Health Canada has classified ear candles as Class 3 medical devices in the same category as joint replacements and dialysis machines indicates that they take them fairly seriously. And their position is best summed up by this quote from their website. The practice of ear candling has recently become popular as an alternative therapy. Some promoters say it is an ancient treatment that can cure a number of medical problems. Don't listen. Ear candling is dangerous and has no proven medical benefits. And that's from the Health Canada website. They have a specific page on ear candling advising people not to use them and letting them know about the regulations of them. As ear candles are a Class 3 device, they require a license to be issued from Health Canada before anyone can sell them for therapeutic purposes. And I'll quote from Health Canada's website again. Health Canada has not issued any licenses for ear candles. Therefore, the sale of this product for therapeutic purposes in Canada is illegal. As well, both Canada and the United States have issued directives that ban the importing of ear candles. Some promoters try to get around Health Canada's medical devices regulations by advertising that ear candles are for entertainment purposes only. However, Health Canada maintains that these people are selling the product illegally for medical purposes, as there is no other reasonable use for ear candles. So it's really quite cut and dry. Health Canada thinks they're dangerous. They have not issued any licenses. Any sale or importation of ear candles in Canada is illegal.
So, of course, there are still people in companies that aren't following those rules.
Yes. Unfortunately, just by Health Canada putting requirements on things, people aren't going to suddenly stop using them or manufacturing them. So there are dozens of spas, beauty clinics, wellness centers, complementary and alternative medicine practitioners all over Canada that offer ear candling as a service. And health food stores still stock products being made illegally in Canada. And part of the problem is that not everyone is aware that they're illegal, but investigations that I have done have led me to believe that most manufacturers, practitioners, and vendors are well aware of the illegality, but they continue to offer the service and sell the candles.
Well, talk a bit about some of that investigative work that you've done.
I started investigating ear candles when I came across them in a Choices Market. Choices is Western Canada's largest retailer of natural and organic food. And in their healthcare departments, they sell all manner of supplements, vitamins, herbal remedies, etc. And one day I happened to notice that they were selling ear candles. And I didn't know much about ear candles at the time, and I didn't know that they were illegal, but I thought something was a bit odd. So I decided to just check into it. So I went to the usual sources, Wikipedia. I just Googled ear candles skeptic, and I came up with a number of good blog posts and newspaper articles, and I found the Health Canada website, which was linked to from the ear candles page on Wikipedia, and found out that they were actually illegal to sell. So it didn't take me very long to find out that Choices was actually selling them illegally. So I decided to call them and let them know. So I gave them the benefit of the doubt and decided to approach the call from the angle of informing them as a concerned customer that they were selling something illegal. But the head of the healthcare department that I was put through to was not concerned at all. She'd been assured by her supplier that everything was above board, that she had seen a letter from Health Canada saying that the manufacturer was allowed to sell them the candles. I asked if I could see a copy of the letter. She said she didn't have it at the moment, but she'd get the manufacturer to contact me. Seeing how I wasn't getting anywhere, I asked if, regardless of whether they had permission or not, I could submit a complaint to Choices based on the fact that they were selling a product that Health Canada had described as dangerous and ineffective. But she told me that they would sell their customers what they wanted to buy, and she could not speak to that. Much to my surprise, I did actually receive a call from the manufacturer of the Candelia candles that I saw in the store. Candelia is owned by Norm Land. Norm told me that he had been told by a Health Canada official at some conference that there were no ear candle police and that you could sell the product as long as you didn't make any claims about it on the label. He also claimed that he had a letter from Health Canada giving him permission to sell his candles. But when I asked him if he could send me a copy to satisfy my curiosity, he declined and said that actually it was a letter to his friend's ear candle company.
Ah.
And he wouldn't be able to send it to me without asking his friend's permission first. So I decided to report this illegal sale of ear candles to Health Canada. They have a toll-free number which you can get on the website for complaints and concerns specifically about medical devices. And I spoke to someone who took down my details, and I was very happy to get an email from a senior compliance officer of the Inspectorate Program of Health Canada who asked me for all the details I could give, and Choices has taken them off the shelf. Whether that's due to my complaint, I can't say for sure. And the company, Candelia, is under investigation by the Health Canada authorities in Alberta.
This is an amazing story, to tell you the truth. Not many people would go to these kind of lengths for this.
Actually, it wasn't that much work. Health Canada has done its research. It is of the opinion that they're dangerous and ineffective, and they have refused to issue any licenses for ear candles. This is a situation where skeptics can complain, send the information to Health Canada, you can stay completely anonymous, and they do actually go after complaints that people put in, so they take it seriously. This is a skeptic's dream. We wish they did this for everything.
Now you are a man on a mission. Tell us about your project.
I have started a website, earcandlesareillegal.net, that contains all the information to report the illegal sale, manufacture, or importation of ear candles to Health Canada. It's got all the relevant laws and websites and summary of all the research. It's got the numbers you need to call, a quick, easy guide for finding out the relevant information that makes Health Canada's job of investigating easy. And you can read all about the investigations that I've done and my complaint to Health Canada.
I've heard about some pretty strange alt health treatments. So why did you choose this as your focus?
I chose ear candles partly because I've got a complaint in myself, and partly because in the process of making that complaint, I realized how simple a process this is. I figure we can quite easily get a lot of ear candles off shelves and shut down the existing companies that continue to make ear candles in Canada.
So let me play devil's advocate here. If people want to do something that is potentially going to hurt them, why should you care?
It's just a matter of consumer protection. Ear candles might sound like just another silly alt med treatment, but they are a class 3 medical device along with dialysis machines and joint replacements. You have to hold them to the same standard of evidence for safety and efficacy.
So where can people find your site?
It's earcandlesareillegal.net. I ask all skeptics to please link to it on their web pages, like the Facebook page, share it with all their friends, and make sure you know what to do if you see ear candles being sold somewhere in Canada. Because no matter what the owner of the store says, it is illegal, and it's easy to get them off the shelves and keep people safe.
Thanks very much for being here, Jamie.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And we'll be right back with Dr. Stephen Barrett of Quackwatch after this.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
I'm here with Dr. Stephen Barrett. Stephen is the Vice President of the Institute for Science and Medicine and a Fellow of the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry. He's an award-winning author, editor, and consumer advocate. And he's also the creator of Quackwatch, a network of websites that investigates and reports on all kinds of dubious medical claims. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Dr. Barrett.
Thank you.
So I definitely want to get your take on some specific treatments, but first, let's talk about you and your work with Quackwatch. So first of all, can you explain what you mean by quackery?
Generally, it involves overclaim in the field of health and the promotion of unsubstantiated methods that have no plausible rationale.
And so what does Quackwatch do then to try and combat quackery?
Quackwatch is one of several outlets that I have to try to communicate what's wrong. We talk about some of the people that we think are promoting quackery, but mostly we focus on misleading propaganda techniques and that sort of thing.
So how long have you been doing this then?
I started gathering information in the late 1960s. And as the years went by, I spent more and more time doing that and less time at my profession, which is psychiatry.
Well, so in addition to the main Quackwatch site, there are over 20 affiliate sites on specific types of questionable medical claims. So how did you choose which topics deserve their own sites?
I like the idea that when people go to a website, they can browse an index to see what the information contains. So what happened is that the index at the original site, which is Quackwatch, was quite long. And as we got concentrations of information on other topics, I split them off into separate sites so that people could navigate them more easily.
Well, how did you decide which topics deserved their own sites? Because you were a psychiatrist before you retired, as you mentioned. And no one can be an expert in every one of the areas that you would have to be able to comment on all of these different types of treatments.
Well, you don't have to be an expert to comment.
Right.
You have to be an expert at putting information together. Now, there are some topics that I've looked at enough with enough consultation or I have enough background to actually have a pretty expert knowledge of the marketplace. But medical writers write all the time on lots of topics, some of which they start out knowing nothing about when they start. I have the advantage of having gone to medical school and having been in and around medical practice for some 50 years. Plus, I have a huge list of people who can help me if I ask questions. Plus, I have my own in-house expert, my wife, who's a with a family practitioner who can handle a lot of the medical things.
Well, as you said, you do have quite a network of advisors.
Oh, yeah. We've had over 1,000 people volunteer. I probably have used maybe 100 of them at various times. But I have a huge list in case I get into something more obscure.
So you've had to battle proponents of quack medicine in court a few times as well.
Well, I was the object of a libel campaign that was really vicious, and I sued quite a number of people. Some of the suits were successful, some were not. The courts are not particularly sympathetic toward libel. The laws are structured so that it's possible to get away with an awful lot on the Internet.
Well, has anyone actually ever won a judgment against you?
No, no one ever will.
I like that.
I mean, in order to win a judgment against me for libel, you have to demonstrate that, number one, I was wrong, number two, I was deliberately wrong, and number three, I refuse to pay any attention when you complain. It's possible to write something inaccurate. That doesn't make it libelous. To prove libel, you have to show that the person intended to publish something that was false, pretty much with reckless disregard for the truth. And I'm not recklessly disregarding anything. Somebody complains to me, I take the complaint very seriously and check very carefully. I've had two suits filed against me. One was tossed with a motion to dismiss because they actually failed to identify anything that was defamatory. Never got to the point where we had to argue over whether anything was true. The second suit is ongoing, and we filed a motion to dismiss based on many things, including the fact that they actually haven't identified a single statement that's either false or defamatory. And I expect it will be dismissed, but we'll have to see.
Have you ever removed or altered an article on Quackwatch as the result of maybe not even a lawsuit, but any threats?
I've modified many articles in response to complaints. Makes no difference whether there's a threat. If somebody makes a complaint and I see that there's merit to it, I make a change. Whether or not there's a threat makes no difference. There have been some that where somebody, for example, complained that some minor factual error, which I change them in 10 minutes. Other complaints have involved ways of interpreting what I wrote. Somebody might interpret it one way when it wasn't what I intended. The person complained, said, hey, you know, what you wrote could be taken as meaning this, and that wouldn't be true. And I change that, of course. I don't think that anyone has ever complained about a serious error.
I'm probably speaking about simply the proponents of these kind of treatments and practices. Do you get a lot of emails from them?
I probably have had about 30 or 40 threats from people or their attorneys in the last dozen years.
Actually, that's pretty good.
Well, I'm extremely careful. I don't call people names, and I tend to work from documents. I don't go on the basis of what somebody tells me about somebody. I make sure that there's written evidence, either posted on the person's site or a court document or something.
Right.
You have to be very careful. I mean, I can assure you that if I were not careful, I would have been sued into oblivion long ago. I write mostly about concepts. For example, we have an article on 25 ways to spot a quack. I don't name anybody. I don't call anybody a quack. Basically, this is an article that talks about what are the warning signs that somebody is untrustworthy. For example, that if somebody says that everybody needs vitamins, that person should not be trusted. And I have a second concept that goes with that, which is, if somebody is not almost 100% accurate, you should ignore the person completely. It's not a good idea to try to sort out good information from bad at a source. You should confine yourself to sources that are nearly 100% accurate. If you try to go to a site, for example, that's 90% accurate, that's a terrible number. I mean, we're not talking about batting averages. We're talking about advice that can affect your life. And you ought to go to sites that are in line with the best of the scientific community. And we identify about 500 of them. You know, they're very good places to start.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Barrett, the creator of Quackwatch, your guide to quackery, health fraud, and intelligent decisions. So we've taken a long look at the various sites in the Quackwatch family, and we've chosen some specific treatments that we'd like you to explain for our audience, mostly just ones that we found really interesting. How about iridology?
That's silly stuff, the claim that you can look in someone's eyes and tell what's wrong with their body. It gives people who don't have a medical license the ability to pretend that they can diagnose something and they can sell you supplements.
Well,
there have been a couple of studies that actually looked at the accuracy of some iridologists, but it doesn't really make much difference. I mean, you can study it forever, and the outcome's not going to be any different, and most people who do it are not going to pay any attention.
So is there...
And people who wind up being victimized generally have placed their trust in the wrong places.
And I assume that this can be said for a lot of the topics that you cover on Quack Watch. It's just people don't know any better. They haven't done the research.
In some cases, people don't know better. In other cases, they're alienated. Some people are desperate. Probably the majority of them are simply not sufficiently skeptical. They may trust advice from a friend, or they may talk to someone who claims to have had a favorable experience, and so on. Probably lack of appropriate level of skepticism is the main factor that gets people to try various things that don't make sense. And, of course, there's also lots of publicity, and people tend to believe what they hear the most.
Well, something like iridology, it does sound sort of silly on its face, just the idea of being able to diagnose or treat anything just by looking at your eyes. But you make the point repeatedly that it's still dangerous in certain ways, even though it's just silly.
The danger is mostly financial, but I'm sure there are some people who get misdirected because they need standard care and rely on somebody unreliable instead, or because they go to someone and then they get frightened about what they've been told and they wind up spending a lot of money getting reassured. I don't hear as much about iridology as I do about the false diagnosis of toxicity, for example. That seems to be a far greater problem in the marketplace, where people are told that they have one kind of toxicity or another, and then some of them wind up spending a lot of money going to regular doctors to have the tests repeated, and they find out there's nothing wrong with them.
Can you explain that, toxicity?
There's a network of practitioners who regard toxicity of mercury, lead, or other heavy metals as a common problem, and everybody that walks in their door is a suspect. Many of them do a urine test where they give a chelating agent, that is a chemical that causes people to excrete extra amounts of whatever they happen to have circulating. And they do a urine test that comes back and says, you have a high level, or you have a very high level of mercury or lead or aluminum or something like that in your urine. You need to have treatment to take it out. And those test results are never correct.
But isn't this one of these kind of ideas that's rooted in a bit of truth? There are cases where there are toxic levels of whatever the case may be in somebody's system.
Well, more no than yes.
Okay.
First, to make a diagnosis, let's say you have mercury toxicity, mm-hmm. you have to have symptoms of mercury toxicity. And you have to have exposure to toxic levels. And almost nobody has exposure to toxic levels. I would say that of the people who undergo this urine testing, that the number of people who actually have a problem is probably close to zero. Granted, if you have occupational exposure to mercury at very high levels, you can get sick, but I'm not sure that ever happens anymore. If you eat huge amounts of fish that have mercury in them, you can wind up with high levels, maybe not high enough to make you sick, but high enough to be concerning. There aren't a lot of people that do that. And if they actually wind up getting tested by a standard physician, they're not going to be told that they need treatment. They're just going to be told to stop eating fish that contain mercury.
But I think maybe one of the problems is that this is sort of one of the realms of quackery that sort of starts with some basis in science, but then it just completely exaggerates or expands the claims. And in my opinion, this is why people fall for it, because it sounds like something that they've heard before that is actually based in fact.
It's probably easier to talk about that from the point of view of lead toxicity. You get lead toxicity by eating lead paint.
Right.
Lead-containing paint if you're a kid. And that's real. You can get lead toxicity if you have lead in your paint and you have it taken out of your house without proper precautions. You can breathe it in. End of story. They haven't used lead paint in paints in this country, I think, for about 30 years. There is still some residual, and kids who eat the paint off the walls are going to get in trouble.
Right.
But, and that's real, but it's got nothing to do with the kind of toxicity testing I'm talking about.
Right.
The kind I'm talking about, you go to a doctor who pretty much believes that everybody is toxic, and gives a provoking agent, that is a chelating agent, a chemical that artificially raises the amount in your urine, then sends to a lab that specializes in this kind of testing and reports it as high when it isn't.
Right.
The people who get into the system where they're advised to have chelation don't have lead toxicity.
Well, so
they just go to somebody who sees it everywhere.
But is this where we see the little in-the-box detox programs that people go on?
They're not usually medically advised, and they're not usually preceded by testing. They're promoted with the idea that toxins are everywhere and that everybody could benefit.
Right.
And this may be believable to people who, you know, they think, well, I go out in the street, I breathe in exhaust from car fumes, or, you know, maybe I've accumulated some toxins somewhere because everybody knows there's too many chemicals around. So the people that sell cleanses rely on a general public feeling that there are too many toxins, and that, of course, is promoted by lots of people who are selling the idea that there are too many toxins. So there's your grain of truth.
Right.
It's a different marketplace from the medical doctors who are selling chelation therapy.
In these cleanses, do they ever actually specify what toxins they're supposedly removing from the body?
I would say not usually. I mean, I've seen lots of promotions. I don't recall seeing any specified, but it wouldn't surprise me if somebody does.
Well, I guess the obvious question would be then, how did we survive as a species for this long without the ability to remove all these horrible poisons from our bodies?
That's one logical way of looking at it, but that's handled in advance by saying cancer is on the increase and chronic diseases are on the increase, and you have all kinds of incorrect statistics to back up those kinds of statements. Cancer is on the increase because people are living longer. It's a primarily disease of old age. It's not because people are getting exposure to toxins. But those ideas are very widespread. And people selling different kinds of products promoted. For example, people selling organic foods, saying you're getting toxins in your foods. Well, so, okay, they're not necessarily promoting cleanses, but the people who are promoting cleanses benefit from the promoters of organic foods who say that people are absorbing toxins.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. We're talking to Dr. Stephen Barrett, the creator of QuackWatch. And we'll be right back with more after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, it's an hour of semen science. Evolutionary biologist John Logsdon explains the amazing diversity of sperm design and its connection with mating behavior. And Scientopia blogger Cy Curious joins us to discuss some of our favorites from her Friday Weird Science archives. We'll talk about everything from the antidepressant properties of semen to smelly semen to testicle receptacles and so very much more. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 Mountain Time at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm here with Dr. Stephen Barrett, creator of QuackWatch, a network of websites that shines a spotlight on the frequently not evidence-based claims of alternative medicine. So it seems that there is sort of a group of these alternative health treatments that sort of rely on the idea that different parts of the body are connected somehow, and dysfunction in one place can be diagnosed by looking at something else. Specifically, I'm thinking of reflexology.
Well, there are a whole bunch of systems that say that you can look at one part of the body and it serves as a map for trouble in other places. Reflexology says you can look at the hands and feet. There's an ear acupuncture that called auricular therapy that says that the body is mapped on the ear. You have iridology, it's mapped on the eyes. You have certain types of chiropractic. The body is mapped on the spine. There are probably half a dozen others that I can't think of offhand.
Well, so in reflexology's case specifically, the claim is that all of the organs are represented by different spots on the hands and feet, right?
Yes.
Okay, so
there are no anatomical pathways that would permit this.
That's what
and
I was going to ask.
Of course, there's no study that shows that reflexology has any effect against disease.
Well, and this is the thing. It sort of takes the leap from diagnosis to actual treatment, right? They claim that massaging those spots can have a beneficial effect on the corresponding organ.
They do. I actually had an interesting experience with a reflexologist. I went with a television crew to an expo, and one of the things they did was they had me undergo reflexology. I happened to have had a problem in one of my shoulders from swimming where the tendon was rubbing against a little bony protrusion and had gotten inflamed, and I had pain in my shoulder when I moved my arm. And it had been diagnosed, and it showed on X-ray, and I was scheduled for surgery. I went there and said I had a shoulder pain. He says, "Oh, I can see that in your foot. Wait a minute. I'll massage that spot." And so he mashed on my foot and said, "You should be better in a couple of weeks." You know, he could see what was wrong with my shoulder. He didn't have the slightest idea what was wrong. Of course, I had surgery with they took an electric drill and threw a scope and shaved the ledge, and I've never had any trouble since.
So this is supposed to be, and I understand there are no scientific pathways that this could happen along, but proponents would say that this was due to energy, you know, stimulating the flow of energy.
There are a whole bunch of these things where some people claim they can wave their hands over you and feel your energy field and influence it. Others claim they can touch you and transmit energy. Some people have devices that they claim can measure energy and relate it to what's wrong with you and what you need. There are dozens of varieties of these things. What they have in common is that there's no scientific instrument that can measure the energy, and there's no evidence that what they do has any effect or that their diagnoses make any sense. There have only been a few tests conducted to see whether they actually can measure anything with any consistency. The best study of all was done by a child, Emily Rosa, who was 10 and 11 years old, who got the 21 practitioners of therapeutic touch to agree to a test. The practitioners put their hands through a screen where they couldn't see them. She put one of her hands over the practitioner's hand, and the practitioner was to tell whether he or she could feel her energy field. And by chance, you would get half right. Well, they got it back a little more than half wrong.
Now, one of the better known of this type, the one that relies explicitly on energy fields, is acupuncture. So how is that supposed to work?
There's two ways of looking at acupuncture, what I call the secular way and the traditional way. The traditional way says that the body has an energy flow. It flows through channels that are above the skin, and using acupuncture needles or some other method, you can influence the flow, relieve blockages, fix the energy blockage, and cause people to get better. The traditional way is senseless. But there are also acupuncturists who say that by doing something to the skin, you may either produce some kinds of compounds or influence the perception of pain or some other things. There's some body of literature that suggests that acupuncture might have some usefulness in the temporary relief of pain. I personally don't think it does. I think that any relief that's been demonstrated is likely to be short-lived and not worth the money.
Well, this is one that I'm really interested in because it does seem on a number of fronts like maybe the jury's still out on this.
It depends. I think that people who have looked most closely don't think the jury is out and think that there's never going to be any practical use. I don't think there's going to be any practical use. The minor pain relief that may accompany acupuncture is temporary. They talk about acupuncture can relieve the nausea of chemotherapy. Well, I'm not sure that's been proven. There's a study that showed it, but I'm not sure it was well designed. My answer to that is, so what? You know, if you can take a pill that relieves it, what's the point of spending $100 and getting an acupuncture treatment?
Well, now, acupuncture has a pretty strong placebo effect in terms of certain kinds of pain relief, correct?
I'm not so sure that that's true. Placebo effects tend to be temporary, so whether it's useful or not, I don't know. I don't think placebo effects last more than a few hours. The placebo effect may appear to have some usefulness if you have something that is temporary and you hit it at just the right time and it doesn't come back, but it would have gone away anyway. I don't think the placebo effect has a great deal of significance in the marketplace.
Interesting.
Other than minor temporary relief. Most people get confused not by the placebo effect, but by the variability of symptoms and the tendency of symptoms either to go away or to wax and wane. Most symptoms go away by themselves. Most ailments are minor, and most minor ailments resolve by themselves. So it isn't the placebo effect, it's coincidence that is more likely to persuade people that they've been helped.
This is Skeptically Speaking, and we're talking today about bogus health treatments with Dr. Stephen Barrett, the creator of the QuackWatch website family. There's a few treatments, they're basically weird, that you've written about on your site. So one of the ones that I found oddly fascinating was craniosacral therapy. Now, that's the claim that diseases can be diagnosed by simply feeling the patient's head.
The claims for that get into something really weird. And the guy who is the major promoter talked about how he manages to somehow talk to babies in utero and get signals from, and just totally wacky. But the craniosacral folks claim that they can feel a pulse that represents the pulse of cerebrospinal fluid. There's a fluid compartment that bathes some of the nerves and spinal cord and brain. I went to a class at a chiropractic college where the students were being instructed as to how to feel the craniosacral pulse. I sat in as in the same way as students would. Everybody paired up. I couldn't feel any. And my partner couldn't feel mine, and most people couldn't feel anything, and I guess a few people thought they felt something. I don't know what they felt. It'd be a very simple thing to test whether people can actually feel it. And that is, if you can actually feel it, then 10 people who feel the same person should report the same experience. What's interesting about most of the quack diagnostic approaches like that is that they've never been validated. They've never even been tested for consistency, much less validity.
Right.
Why have the proponents not even attempted to demonstrate consistency? There have been a few skeptical studies that found no consistency. If there's no consistency, there can't be validity.
You know, I'm even trying to figure out, what are they supposed to be doing? Are they diagnosing and treating?
Yes, and they vary in what they do. The most outrageous case I know of was a girl with epilepsy where the practitioner made her diagnosis and purported to be doing treatment and told her to stop her medicine, and she died. The practitioner went to jail for insurance fraud, but it's secondary.
You know, and this is one of the things that I was reading on your site, and upon my initial reading, I assumed this was something that had happened in the history of medical treatment, and this is something that was in use, like bloodletting and leeches, before we found science. And that is not the case. This is still in use.
Oh, yeah, it's just still in use, it's never been mainstream. And I don't know how many schools teach it. I mean, what's happened is that in the last 15 years, the quacks managed to get a branch of the National Institute of Health set up to promote this stuff, and they've managed to seed a bunch of medical schools with departments that promote various so-called alternative methods. I don't know how many of them promote cranial therapy is real. I suspect very few. But what's happened is that these little departments have become magnets for people with strange ideas, and so some of them are seeping through to medical students. But most of the people who practice cranial sacral therapy are either osteopathic physicians or chiropractors.
I'm sort of taking for granted at this point. This is something else that you and your advisors have looked at and just found absolutely no evidence that this has any benefit whatsoever.
No, beyond no evidence, it's absurd.
Well, there's that.
Absurd is absurd. There's not going to be any evidence if it's absurd. But there are lots of things where there are no evidence that are not absurd. You know, everything new starts out as unproven and no evidence. That doesn't make it not worthwhile. But things that have no plausible rationale are very unlikely to turn out to be useful. I don't know of anything that had no plausible rationale that in the last 50 years turned out to be useful, except for one thing. You know, that was the discovery that of H. pylori, the bacteria that can cause ulcers. It seemed very implausible that bacteria could live in the acid environment of the stomach. But the man who made the original proposal for this being the case didn't act like a quack. He simply said, what do I have to do to demonstrate it? And then he went ahead and did.
Well, in my conversations with people, I tend to say that if people really think that their chosen alternative health treatment is really working and they think they have evidence of that, then what they should be doing is pushing for clinical trials of whatever treatment it is. And
No, you don't think so? You're on the right track.
Okay.
What they should be doing is documenting it in the proper way. You don't start with a clinical trial. That's expensive and difficult to do.
Right.
You start by keeping careful records of individual cases, simply documenting cases very carefully so that you can compare that with what you would expect, so that you can demonstrate that it looks like they might be doing something useful. That's not proof, but that's preliminary evidence that could then be used to try to interest people in doing a clinical trial.
Would it really be considered preliminary evidence if it's only in one person, one person's documentation?
One case is unlikely to arouse much scientific interest. You know, if it's a serious disease that has a very unexpected result, then it might arouse enough interest for someone to think about it. A single case history is unlikely to be useful unless you're talking about something like, you know, the first person who got penicillin. You know,
right.
There was 100% death rate, and suddenly somebody got this antibiotic and was cured. That's not what we're talking about. A lot of people think that because they had underwent an experience and feel better, that what they did was useful. Most of those cases, it's just coincidence. They had a condition that was self-limiting, and they did something, and they became believers. They would have gotten better anyway.
So even on a site as comprehensive as Quackwatch, and honestly, it was very difficult to pick out just a couple of things that I wanted to ask you about. Could you give us some tips on how to spot a treatment that might turn out to be quackery?
Certain kinds of language should make you very suspicious of the source of information. The one that's most widespread I already mentioned, which is the claim that everybody should take supplements. The second way, as a practical tip, has nothing to do with evaluating whether the treatment works, but I've made an observation over the last 40 years that I've never found anybody who sells dietary supplements, homeopathic products, or minerals or herbs who should be regarded as trustworthy. So that if you go to a website or see a book or an ad or anything else, and the source involves the sale of these products, leave, because they're not going to tell you the truth. It just doesn't happen. I've looked at tens of thousands of the ways that people selling products have communicated. They have never found one. And I have a theory about why, and that is that if you tell the truth about dietary supplements, you can't make money selling them. Because what you have to tell people is how to tell if you don't need them. And no site that sells these products ever talks about when you don't need them. All they talk about is why you should take them. And most people don't need them.
Dr. Barrett, thanks very much for being here.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
You can find Dr. Barrett's work at quackwatch.org. There's also a link to Quackwatch on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. And while you're there, click the links to Twitter, to Facebook, to iTunes, and you can download past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Hi there, my name is Pam Walls, and I'm the director of the Center for Inquiry, Ontario. I remember my first and only time being a client of an alternative medicine practitioner, an iridologist. I was about 20 and was getting fed up with being processed through my regular doctor's office like I was on a production line, waiting in the big room, then waiting in the little room, until finally the doctor emerged, looking through my file rather than looking at me. I had been to my doctor several times with the same complaint. My stomach hurt. I always got the same recommendation. I needed to drink less and eat better, and was quickly ushered out as the next person in line went in. Feeling like I wasn't being truly listened to, I went to an iridologist. Someone who claims they can see what's wrong with you by looking at the changes in the color of your iris. Now, I'm not sure what she would say to the fact that the iris doesn't drastically change colors depending on whether or not someone has indigestion, but I went with it, almost entirely because she listened to me. She didn't make me wait. It was in a sterile, cold, white room. She was friendly and welcoming and asked me all sorts of questions about myself. I must have sat with her for a half hour. From looking into my eyes, she drew out a picture of what was going on inside my body and said she could easily make me feel 100 times better. When we finally emerged from the room, she grabbed a big basket and started piling bottle after bottle of various kinds of pills and herbal remedies. She was so confident and sure that these would help me that I believed it too. When we got to the checkout, it was well over $200, but I still felt satisfied with the experience. I did feel a lot better after my visit, sticking to her strict diet and taking the many pills every day. But in essence, it was exactly what my regular doctor told me to do, drink less and eat better. Except this time, I listened. How you deliver your message may seem like a trivial thing, but I think it is one of the biggest draws of alt-med practitioners. They make people feel like they are being listened to and are important. We really need to re-examine our rigid and impersonal healthcare system, or I fear more and more people will be lost to ineffective and costly alt-med remedies.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. You call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking on mind reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds, and
sham's the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.